May it please the court. This is a dissolution case. The issue in the case is whether the testimony at a dissolution hearing by one party to the dissolution overcomes the statutory presumption that statutory maintenance terminates on remarriage, absent a writing or decree expressing an obligation to continue the maintenance payments past the remarriage.
Could we redirect you?
I'm confident that you have that capacity.
The question first is whether the statute requires that there be an express difference, that it expressly abrogates the statutory provisions as to when maintenance terminates. And the Cade case, is it the last case out of this court?
No, Your Honor, I think Glenn versus Snyder is the last case out of this court, written by Judge Limbaugh, which takes Cates even a step farther and says even in the presence of ambiguity, the statute controls the whatever the written document is. And so if there is ambiguity and silence, that maintenance terminates.
Well, the statute, the Court of Appeals cases have interpreted the statute as requiring that the written document expressly abrogate the statute. And the provision in the statute that says there must be an express abrogation, does that apply to the written agreement of the parties or only to the trial court's judgment?
Well, it can be. The statutory presumption can be overcome in two different ways. One, in the written agreement itself, in which there has to be, I think if you read Cates and Snyder, there has to be an express provision stating that maintenance continues past.
Well, the language of the statute is, unless otherwise agreed in writing or expressly provided in the judgment. So expressly only governs the judgment. It doesn't govern the agreement in writing.
Well, I think it says agreed in writing. The only thing that's agreed in writing are those things that are expressed, particularly when you have a merger clause. So,
and what is the writing in this case?
The writing in this case is a separation agreement.
And what does the writing say?
The writing says, and I've provided it for you at tab number 4, the paragraph that we are dealing with. Tab number 4 says, the parties agree after examining all relevant factors, blah, 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 no mention that the payment is to be made for 15 years at $12,000 per month, and the payment shall terminate prior to the expiration of said 15-year period only in the event of death of either party. That's the relevant language, and I think if Mr. Carmody has the view that there's other language, he'll say it, but I think up till now that's been the...
Why doesn't the use of the word only make it an agreement in writing? It doesn't say shall terminate upon in the event of death of either party, which in which case it wouldn't address other situations when it might or might not terminate. But it says only in the event of the death of either party. Isn't that a written agreement that says that that's the only basis and the only understanding of that is that that doesn't apply to remarriage?
Well, Your Honor, that's an interpretation the court could adopt. It's inconsistent with the precedent of this court.
Is it consistent with the statute?
It's inconsistent, in my view, with the statute.
Is it consistent with and with their agreement?
And with the agreement. With the agreement.
What does the word only mean, if not that?
Well, according to the Western District in the Matic case, it basically says that it doesn't matter what else. It may create an ambiguity, but it does not matter because the statute has to be followed.
Yeah, but I mean, what's ambiguous? It says it shall terminate only in the event of death. Even if it said an express agreement, I'm not clear why that wouldn't qualify, but it just says a written agreement.
Well, Your Honor, I go back to the core principles here, which are that dissolution is a statutory action and not a common law action. And the only thing that this court can do is what the statute says.
I completely agree.
And the statute says that you must express it in writing, that it must, and it's not an expression of what doesn't happen, it's an expression that the remarriage terminates. So there must be an affirmative statement that maintenance continues past remarriage. That builds on the idea that maintenance is a specialized thing adopted by the General Assembly merely for the purpose of providing sustenance to a needy spouse up until the time that that terminates.
If there's an ambiguity, can that be resolved by the oral statements made under oath by the husband in court?
Well, Your Honor, that's interesting because, first, what are these oral statements? if there's an ambiguity, is it parole evidence? It's certainly not a stipulation because both parties didn't agree to it. In fact, Mrs. Simpson testified at the hearing that she wanted the agreement as written enforced, not in this new agreement that they suggest was made as a result of Dr. Simpson's testimony. And so, is it a stipulation? No. Is it a judicial admission? No. But even if it were, there is a contrary judicial admission by Mrs. Simpson saying, I don't want this new agreement. I want Exhibit 1, which is the separation agreement. Is it a new agreement? No.
But
there's no agreement.
But you said what you thought it meant, too.
Pardon?
But they said what they thought that agreement meant, which was that it would not terminate on marriage.
Well, Your Honor, are we going to allow parole evidence? There's been no argument in this case that there's ambiguity in the agreement.
But I thought your argument was that they wanted that agreement. So doesn't their understanding of that agreement then control?
Well, it's certainly not an understanding that she put on the record or testified to or that there's any documentation to. And, in fact, the trial judge, who had ample opportunity to write in his decree that separation agreement had been modified, chose not to do that. In fact, the trial judge said, I adopt Exhibit 1, and that's tab 5 in the papers that you have. So if the court is going to follow the precedent...
So is the trial judge to ignore the testimony? Because as a practical matter, we know we have a hearing as it relates to this the settlement agreement. So is the trial judge to ignore what was testified to? Is that your suggestion?
The trial... You start with the proposition, Judge Wimes, that the agreement determines what is at stake here. And the statute says, here is how you determine what the agreement means. The trial judge certainly could say that I think this is unconscionable or that it's amended, but he didn't say that. Now, if the court decides that this statute has a different meaning than it was expressed in Cates and Glenn and Reeves and Maddock, and a whole series of cases, that's what the Supreme Court's for, but we think that is completely inconsistent with the statute and with the cases around the country which have looked at this particular provision, which is part of the Uniform Dissolution of Marriage Act in Washington and Virginia and Kentucky, and have all said, you know what? It means what it says. And the reason it means what it says is there's a very simple solution here. And that is the lawyers writing these things can solve this problem by adding a single sentence every single time. And the absence of that sentence, as it says in Cates, the careful drafter puts himself or herself at risk by not putting this in there because the law has been stated clearly.
What is the case that you cited to that you said Judge Limbaugh wrote?
Glenn versus Snyder.
Isn't it... This idea of parole evidence is somewhat of an odd concept in an uncontested hearing anyway, isn't it? I mean, do we really expect lawyers to object on the grounds of parole evidence at uncontested hearings where presumably both lawyers are trying to get the judge to approve the exhibit that both parties are offering?
No, Your Honor. And frankly, the fact that this agreement doesn't say this is proved by the arguments made. The arguments made are... But for him saying this at the hearing, there is no basis for the court to have ruled otherwise.
I guess that's my point. Do we want lawyers at uncontested hearings to start making objections any time that there's something that might be later interpreted to redefine the terms of the agreement?
Well, I don't think so. It's the reason we have, if you'll see the decree, it's a form. You check the boxes. Now, the forms will get you in trouble if you're not careful about them, but that's what's going on here. There's been an agreement. There's a long history in the record of a pretty heavy-duty fight here that ultimately gets resolved. Everybody goes in. They're tired. They put on the evidence, and the court makes a decision, which, frankly, is contrary to the precedent. When the Court of Appeals got it, it said it's a stipulation. But a stipulation, by definition, by this court as recently as 2 years ago, is a joint agreement. And you can't find anything in this record where Mrs. Simpson's side of this thing agreed with what Dr. Simpson said on the stand.
What about the language only? Terminates only upon remarriage.
Your Honor, but for the statute, I think you'd be right. But the statute says you have to put a specific statement in there.
It doesn't when it's a written agreement. It says express when it's talking about the judgment. It does not say express when it's talking about the written agreement. And the Cates Kate's case says by inference or expressly.
Well, Your Honor, I respectfully disagree, because all the top courts from all nearly all the states that have looked at this have disagreed with that. Virginia, Washington, Kentucky. Not only that, the Uniform Dissolution of Marriage Act says we don't want the courts in this fight. We want this to be resolved by the plain language of what's there. And if you want it to continue, as Judge Who just says in the Maddox case up in the and as Judge Gerton said in the Reeves case in the Eastern District, if you want it to continue, write the sentence.
If we follow your point of view, will we have to overrule Cates?
No, ma'am. I don't believe so. I think it's entirely consistent with Cates. It's entirely consistent with Glenn versus Snyder. And there's a list of cases. And in fact, for 20 years now, this has been the law. And this was the law in place when this particular dissolution was done. It would have been very simple. We wouldn't be here.
I don't see Glenn versus Snyder cited. Do you have a cite?
It's in the original brief, Your Honor. But I've got it right here. And Glenn versus Snyder is 852 at 841. Second.
Well, and Judge Ahuja, in the Western District case, did that relate to the judgment itself and not a settlement? So when you say expressed in the judgment, is that what you're
suggesting? They came in that case with a stipulation that they intended for it to go forward, and he said, and the court up there said, not him, said, too bad. It has to say it in the agreement or in the decree. And not only that, they came in and said, here's proof of the intent. We had crossed out in a draft that it does not extend past remarriage. That was crossed out and initialed. And he said, again, too bad. I'm out of time, but I'm happy to continue if there are questions. So far, I haven't been very happy with the questions.
Thank you very much, Judge.
Let me try to answer a few of the questions first. Judge Fisher, the parole evidence issue, not an issue in this case. In fact, the testimony was elicited by their own lawyer. No objection throughout this proceeding. No objection at the trial court. No objection at the Court of Appeals. No objection here to the introduction of that testimony. It is not an admissible parole. It is consistent with the language of the agreement. And then to Judge Breckenridge and Judge Stith, you look at the language of the agreement. You look at the language that talks about the payments shall terminate prior to the expiration of the 15-year period only in the event of the death of either party. And I fashioned myself standing here in a summary judgment context, in another contract issue, with this very provision. How unambiguous could this provision be? And that if there was someone on the other side suggesting that I'm now disabled, terminate. There's been a remarriage, terminate. There's been a hurricane, terminate. The answer from this court under those circumstances is this is clear and unambiguous, and none of those events operate to terminate the payment obligation here. It is absolutely unambiguous. So what does Cates tell us to do? What does the statute say? Simply stated, let's look at the clear language. Unless otherwise agreed in writing, one avenue, as this court said in Cates, there's two avenues, that's one avenue, or expressly provided in the judgment. The term expressly does not modify anything in the first portion of that statute. Unless otherwise agreed in writing. What can that writing be? Can it be, as this court has said, an admission in court, sworn to under oath? Absolutely.
Is that a writing?
It is the same effect as a writing, Judge Breckenridge. This court has said, and we cited the Akers case, it has the same binding effect as a writing. Indeed, there are 75 statutory references in our statutes that talk about agreements in writing. And this court has entertained issues regarding what does that mean and does this satisfy the writing component. And this court has said under certain circumstances, the writing is satisfied. Many times, time and time again, the statute of frauds, an agreement for the transfer of real estate must be in writing. Let's talk about the exceptions to that writing. Let's talk about what else constitutes a writing. The statute does not say, in order for this expression, this agreement in writing to be effective, the writing must say, like we would do with our arbitration statute, this agreement contains a binding arbitration agreement. This statute does not say, this agreement contemplates that these maintenance obligations will survive remarriage. No such language. The legislature could simply have put that in. If we want Mr. Robertson's interpretation, let's put that in here.
Isn't it more likely, hasn't our case law said that oral statements in court can be considered a writing if both parties specifically agreed to a statement? And I think in one of our cases, they had not reduced the agreement to writing, but came into court and both sides gave the terms of their agreement, and then the court reporter reduced it to a writing. Isn't that more what our cases are saying?
Exactly right, Judge. There's no question about that. And in fact,
I think the
implication is it not, that the sworn testimony is even greater than and more significant than a writing. You're here before the court. So imagine this circumstance. Imagine Judge Sherry probing, asking the questions, getting the answers under oath in that courtroom. Is there any difference? Isn't that of the same effect as this agreed in writing component?
Hypothetically, let me, as a practical matter, what occurs is we're going through the record. Say, in this particular case, not only the attorney who questioned his own client witness stated that, one, clearly that upon remarriage, this does not terminate.
Correct.
What if, let me just take it a step further, I'm just curious, what if also, maybe erroneously, maybe not, he also has stated that as it related to death, okay? So we have that scenario. But then we have the settlement agreement as it comes back to the court and review, and it's like, my God, the settlement says only upon death. Do you see what I'm saying? So we have an inconsistency, clearly. Would you agree?
The remarriage would, then by that, if I understand your question, Judge Weems, the idea would be that the remarriage would also terminate, as opposed to remarriage not terminating the obligation. So here what I'm suggesting is that this is the testimony is absolutely consistent with the language of this agreement itself.
But my point is, the second part of that wouldn't be consistent with the agreement. If in fact, also stated during that testimony that also death would not terminate maintenance, but yet in the settlement between the parties, we have that language only upon death. There's the inconsistency. How would the court reconcile?
I understand that, and that would be, thankfully, not the issue before the court, because that didn't occur. But I think that's a situation where you would have to weigh, is that parole? Is that testimony that is going to vary or contradict in the traditional concepts of parole? And therefore, does that change it? Again, Judge, I think...
Couldn't I make the argument that, notwithstanding that by him testifying to that contradicts the settlement? As Mr. Robertson suggests, therefore, because we're talking parole now at this point.
That component would contradict the written agreement, and then the question would be, is that admissible to vary the terms of that written agreement?
Yeah, but the problem is we never get to the admissibility issue unless there's an objection.
Right. Correct.
That's the problem I have with all this discussion of parole evidence.
Either
way it cuts, I don't understand why it's an issue if there's no objection.
It never was until now, okay. Quite frankly. It never was below, enlisted by their own lawyer. So obviously you're not going to object to your own question.
Do we need to get to this whole transcript issue if is that an alternative to your first argument that the agreement is clear that it says only terminate on death?
Yes. I think the agreement is clear and unambiguous. I recognize that there is language out there in a multitude of cases. This court recognized in Cates that many of the appellate decisions are just products of the idiosyncrasies of their facts. This is a unique set of facts. There's never been a case where you end up with this kind of testimony, this kind of transcript.
Mr. Robertson says if we were to decide this your way, we would be in conflict or inconsistent with how other courts have interpreted the model rule.
And I will suggest to the court, look back at the specific language of Cates and recognize this is entirely consistent with the Cates analysis. The court says in Cates, there being no express provision in the trial court's decree, which I still say this language is an express provision because of it seems very clear to me. It expressly states one event that does not include remarriage, death. There being no express provision in the trial court's decree, we consider the second avenue by which the statutory presumption can be terminated, asking whether Larry's obligation to pay future statutory maintenance was, quote, agreed in writing, end quote. This is exactly what we're asking this court to do. To be sure, there have been cases and there have been language that act like the first portion of this statute in the disjunctive, but that the first portion, forget about. If it's not in that decree, if it's not in the separation agreement, it's not there. That totally misreads the statute, the clear language of the statute. Every judgment, remember that this says expressly provided in the judgment. Every judgment is the decree coupled with the separation agreement. So therefore, that's the second portion. That's the express portion. The other thing is agree in writing. Could I give you, for instance, in the transcript of afterwards, what if there was an appendage to that transcript that said, we hereby agree, as Exhibit 1, that consistent with the language of Chapter 452, this obligation survives remarriage. Not part of the separation agreement, not part of the decree. Would there be any question in this court that that is otherwise an agreement in writing that would obligate both parties? No. What if we went back to somebody's office afterwards and sat down and said, consistent with the language of Chapter 452, we hereby agree, da-da-da-da. What if it's on the back of a napkin? What if it's any other kind of a writing?
I think Mr. Robertson's point, though, is that you didn't do any of those things, and you're relying on the word only or on a transcript being considered a writing. And are either of those sufficient? Why would those be sufficient?
Yes, Judge. And again, if not, then the case is in language from this court saying that a judicial statement under oath, a stipulation, things of that nature. Here we have a transcript. It's a reduction to writing. So there's a time where we may not even need the transcript. If there's an oral admission in court, this court and other courts have said that's sufficient to stand for the writing requirement.
What did the court say in Glenn versus Snyder? Do we have to overrule Glenn versus Snyder to rule in favor of your client?
You do not, Judge. You do not have to overrule Glenn versus Snyder. And it dealt with a prior case, an interpretation of the Dorflinger case that I don't think is necessary in these circumstances.
What were the facts of Glenn versus Snyder?
The Glenn versus Snyder case was one in which Judge Limbaugh ultimately said that there was a reversal of LaBarge, the LaBarge case, or an overruling of the language of that case. But again, it did not involve a circumstance as here. There was limitation on the court's interpretation of how far you could go and how far you could look. Again, I'm suggesting to the court in this case, under these circumstances, that the law should be applied. This is an unambiguous statement crafted by lawyers skilled in their craft, and here is your agreement. No question there. So this ambiguity issue became one, Judge Breckenridge, that was often addressed, but none of these cases that you'll hear about and that have been cited in these briefs, with language and particularly coming out of the Western District, a lot of that language, I believe and we believe, misinterprets this disjunctive in this statute, which has the agreement in writing or the express provision in the settlement agreement.
So are you talking about Mackey and some of those out of the Western District?
Correct.
And so would those need to be distinguished or overruled?
Judge, it depends on the way that you want to go. The fact of the matter is I think that there are circumstances in this case which distinguish the facts here That is, this testimony and this written transcript that distinguished that, and again, there was no objection below to the introduction of the writing, the written transcript, as embodying the agreement of the parties. So I think that the reliance, if the court should deem fit, on that would be sufficient so as not to have to worry about distinction. Another avenue could be the fact that he's really estopped, that we in this state, in this situation that's not present in the other cases, we have a situation here where you have Dr. Simpson saying, I agree that I said that. I agree that we negotiated for this. I agree under oath. Here's what I mean.
And the benefit he got from it was what, that the court approved the dissolution?
Approved the dissolution, Judge. He got a fixed term, non-modification, property division. This is a material term of a very significant agreement that divided property that was bargained for back and forth, that he now says 4 years into a 15-year obligation, owing her throughout that entire term $1.5 million. And he says after 4 years, gotcha. I'm going to go to the Missouri Supreme Court, and I'm going to ask them to say, gotcha. That is absolutely unwarranted under these facts. It's unwarranted under the law, and certainly could not be the message that this court wants to send to litigants, that we've got a gotcha. I'm 4 years into a 15-year obligation, and I'll say goodbye, notwithstanding the fact that I swore to this under oath. We know day in and day out in dissolution dockets all over the state that there are agreements in front of the court, representations made in front of the court. And this is a circumstance where this court, I think, needs say. We think taking an oath under these circumstances is enough. This is more sacrosanct than a writing not under oath. And it can be, like we have said before, a substitute for the writing that's required. In conclusion, the transcript, first and foremost, satisfies the writing requirement. His agreement made while he was under oath, Dr. Simpson was under oath in open court, rebuts the statutory presumption talked about in Cates and is binding and conclusive on him. And then his oral declaration, even if it wasn't independently binding and conclusive, nevertheless bars him from now taking the directly opposite position under the doctrine of judicial estoppel. We believe the trial court's judgment should be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Carmody.
Thank you.
Please, the court, you will have to overrule Glenn versus Snyder.
Glenn versus Snyder, the facts were that the separation agreement said payments will not extend beyond the death of the payee spouse.
Correct.
It did not say they terminate only if this event happens. So the facts are different than this case.
Well, I think that's semantics, Judge, and obviously you get the final say, but when it's the meaning is not different. And here's what Judge Limbaugh says. In other words, where the decree and agreement are silent on this issue, there is nothing to rebut the statutory presumption of termination.
Isn't there a difference when it says maintenance payments will terminate on death? And it doesn't make any reference. But when it says it will only terminate on death, isn't that
Your Honor, you can say that. I don't agree with it, but I don't want to argue the point. What I do want to say is that this separation agreement is provided for in the judgment. It is incorporated in the judgment. It is not a standalone contractual agreement. It is now part of the judgment, so it's clear that it's not expressly provided in the judgment. And I don't know how you can say that something is not expressly provided in the judgment, and it works the opposite way when you have the agreement if it's not incorporated into the decree. And the way the court, I believe, has written these things up to this point, and what's wrong with Mr. Carmody's argument is he's pretending these are common law contracts. They're not. The common law doesn't even recognize this kind of a contract, doesn't permit it. It's statutory, so you have to begin with what does the legislature allow a court to do? And you can't go to these other contractual provisions that Mr. Carmody talks about, a different kind of a real estate contract at all. That's not covered. This is. And you can only do what the statute says. And the court has said, you know, if lawyers want to make sure about this, write it. And we won't be here. You'd have two cases on the docket today. And that case was in effect for 16 years before this thing, or some period of time before this one happened. One of the things the court has to worry about, I think, is what do you tell lawyers? And I think what you tell lawyers is follow the statute. And if you follow the statute, we don't have courts filled up with these little, how about this for an excuse? How about this for a way out? What we have here is a clear rule announced in Cates, followed in Snyder, followed in boom, 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 that says solve this problem. And the only reason it went back in Glenn versus Snyder is because we said we're not going to apply it retroactively. And in that case, the agreement was put in place prior to Cates. My time is up. I thank the court for its time. And I would, and Judge Teitelman, you should have introduced whoever it is that's sitting in for Judge Fisher, because I don't recognize him.
We call him himself. But I want to say, well, I'm happy you were included on the docket. We have two fine attorneys arguing a point of law, which doesn't get any better than that. Thank you.
Thank you.